Welcome to the Perfumed Vice. It's not just the first of this year's panel events on themes from the 2019 Opera Holland Park season, it's also the unlikeliest. I was talking with John Wilkie, who's directing Il Segreto di Susanna this summer, and we realised that while this opera is Volferrari's most famous work, it seems barely to have been studied. Susanna's Secret is a romantic comedy. Alan Malloch, the leading authority on the Giovane Scuola composers, hailed it as second only to Gianni Schicchi, a musical gem. Yet aside from the immense wit and charm of the libretto and the music, this lickety-split one-act farce for two singers and a silent actor is known for only one thing, the fact that its heroine smokes. Susanna is not the first female smoker in operatic history. That's Carmen. But she's the first respectable female smoker in operatic history. A young countess, newlywed to a count, who is unaware of his wife's habit and suspects her of having an affair when he smells smoke in their apartment, in a palazzo. Il Segreto di Susanna is therefore not just about smoking, it's about marriage. So how did Volferrari come to write this particular comedy in 1909? To put Susanna's Secret in context, we have Donald MacLeod of BBC Radio 3. Thank you. We have Josh Spiro, author of the memoir Secondhand Stories, former art critic of Tatler, now with the Financial Times. We also have the economic and social historian, Dr. Rosemary Elliott of the University of Glasgow. Donald, could we perhaps start with a little introduction to Volferrari?
A clean-cut gym in its way and cheerful withal. That was the rather less than totally effusive response of the Daily Telegraph when Susanna's Secret was put on at Covent Garden in 1919. When Anna asked me if I would do a little kind of potted history of the composer tonight, as I did for Mascagni at the event that some of you may have come to last year, I thought, easy peasy, falling off a log. But it turns out that it's not as easy as all that. I looked around despairingly and thought, I'm obviously missing something here. So I rang my great friend Roger Parker, the redoubtable expert on Italian opera who's Thurston Dart Professor of Music at King's College London, and said, Roger, what is it? Who should I read on Volferrari to get the real gen? And he said, I don't think there's anything tremendously useful out there. In fact, there's virtually nothing. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is what I have for you this evening. Virtually nothing. So, Cenerentola, but obviously not that one, Le donne curiosi, I quattro rustichi, I gioielli della Madonna, L'amore medico, Gli amanti sposi, Das Himmelskleid, Sly, La Vedova Scaltra, Il Campiero, La Dama Boba, L'Idei a Tebe, otherwise Der Kuckuck in Theben. That is the total litany of operas by our culprit this evening. The one we're interested in tonight, Il Segreto di Susanna, Susanna's Secret, was first performed, like its two predecessors, at the Hoftheater in Munich in December 1909 as Susanna's Geheimnis, so sung in German in a translation by Max Kalbeck. So the performance history of this composer rather reflects the man. The first opera, Cenerentola, failed when it was first produced at La Fenice in Venice. But the revised version he made was a great success when it was produced in Bremen 2 years later. Our man, Hermann Friedrich Wolf, that was the name that appeared on his baptismal certificate, altogether Teutonic sounding, was born on the 12th of January 1876, a leap year, as it happens, as if that had anything to do with anything, in Venice. It was a year in which, to some, the familiar Bass Brewery Red Triangle was registered as the world's first pucker trade symbol. In the middle of February of that year, Alexander Graham Bell patented his telephone. Edison patented the mimeograph. It was also the year that saw the first production of Ibsen's play Peer Gynt with Edvard Grieg's phenomenal incidental music. And Wagner inaugurated the first Bayreuth Festival. a giant squid more than 6.5 meters long washed ashore in Newfoundland, and Brahms's First Symphony had its first performance in Karlsruhe. I'm not suggesting these events were related in any way. Along with these major world events, Hermann Friedrich first saw the light of day in the Serene Republic. Well, the man himself was aware of this basic dichotomy in his circumstances, and he decided to emphasize it with this double-barreled surname, conjoining his Bavarian dad's name, the painter August Wolff, to his mother's Emilia Ferrari. She was from a noble Venetian family. I said August Wolff was a painter, at least I hope I did. In a rather niche way, it has to be said, he made copies of Italian and Flemish old masters for the poet, historian of literature, and art collector Adolf Friedrich Graf von Schack. And it seems that Wolferei's initial inclination was to follow in his father's footsteps and train as a painter. So at the age of 15, he enrolled at the School of Fine Art in Venice. 2 years after that, in 1891, he moved to Munich to continue his study of painting, and there he had composition lessons with Josef von Rheinberger. You're immediately, of course, about to tell me that he also taught Engelbert Humperdinck. After graduating there, he returned to Venice, and then he began to study Baroque and classical Italian music. As you hear when you listen to it, Wolferei's music reflects that basic duality. On the one hand, the German mastery of counterpoint and orchestration. On the other, what we might think of typically Venetian grace and melodic inspiration and lyricism. I was intrigued to see that up until the 1930s, Wolferei's works were absolutely a standard part of the repertoire around the globe. And he was championed by the likes of Mahler and Toscanini and Victor de Sabata. Nowadays, a few works remain in the concert repertoire, but all the chamber music and the symphonic works have completely vanished. As far as I can see, the historians are simply not agreed on what the reason for that might be. There certainly isn't any suggestion that it's because the music isn't any good. He's undoubtedly a composer who looks to the past fondly and with a certain elegance, and it may well be that that's something that people simply don't value anymore. Maybe there's a certain quality of nostalgia about Wolferei, but I think he does have a rather personal and independent musical aesthetic. He essentially presented 18th century style in 20th century orchestration. He's been described as immersing himself completely in the music of the past to create a continuity with Mozart or Rossini, who for him embody universal, timeless values. And this at a period when Mascagni's Verismo and the psychological theatre of Puccini were all the rage. Though in fact, The Jewels of the Madonna, his only tragic opera, was influenced by Mascagni's realistic style. I guess, reeking of the past as it did, in post-war Italy, when anything remotely recalling the war or Italy's fascist era was automatically rejected, that pretty much meant curtains for Wolferei. Reading the pathetically meager amount of material that's available about a composer, he emerges as a gentleman with a rather childlike manner. His music always reflected a certain conservative bent. Writers have speculated that his anguished situation during World War I, when the two countries of his heritage were in conflict with each other, was something that he never recovered from. He suffered from depression after the war and divorced his wife. He took up the visual arts again and created something like 130 nudes. In the 1940s, the destruction of or closure of most of the German theatres, along with the post-war change of taste, led Wolferei to descend into poverty and further depression. And he died of a heart attack in 1948, buried in Venice's cemetery island of San Michele. Just to end with some kind of random jottings about smoking and opera or the big screen. I find it interesting that these days, you'll have noticed it too, in lots of productions that up update operas from the original setting to something contemporary in the 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s. There are endlessly people smoking on stage. The recent staging, although it was contemporary, at Covent Garden of Janáček's From the House of the Dead, rather startlingly began with the image of the glowing end of a cigarette in the total darkness. I was interested to read that the biggest business in Bayreuth, apart from everything Wagnerian, was a cigarette factory. Camel Cigarettes was a brand that promoted itself as less impactful on the throat, and the brand used opera singers to promote the product. One of them was Marguerite Piazza. Another was Robert Merrill. In one advert, he was asked, why do so many singing stars smoke Camels? He answered, in my case, what with rehearsals, heavy schedules at the opera, TV shows and concert tours, I can't take chances with my voice. I have to have a cigarette that agrees with my throat, and Camels fill the bill. They're mild and they taste great. Anna.
So far, our backdrop tonight has been Edward Muybridge's motion study of a smoking woman, image courtesy of the Wellcome Collection, dated 1887. In visual art, almost more than in music, you see very clearly how the female smoker is framed by each era, outlawed or idolized or normalized. To talk us through this history, I'd like to hand over to Josh Spiro.
Thank you so much. When I've heard of having a hard act to follow, but never actually a really hard act to follow. That was wonderful, thank you. So, we're going to talk about women and cigarettes, but cigarettes are, from the start, for men. This is what people who make cigarettes want us to believe. So, if you have a look at this card from a cigarette packet, you have a woman, she's on fire, obviously, because what else do women do but be on fire? And then you have a man coming in to save her while she's very decorously laying there on fire. I don't know, perhaps it's not clear why she's on fire, but perhaps she has had a cigarette and has used it wrongly and put it in her mouth and set her skirt on fire. But maybe that's a warning, women shouldn't smoke. The same thing, we have a different approach. We have a Musha here. These were adverts, again, for smoking. And the woman looks like she's having a really good time. She is very much enjoying that cigarette, but I suspect there is something kind of phallic going on at the same time. But you can see that these are aimed at men to show you, to suggest that by smoking you will arouse your woman. So it's very much still directed in a male way. But then women, you know, goddamn, took up smoking. They couldn't stop them. But that didn't mean that society wouldn't view them as doing something mannish. So, emancipation, obviously, a lot of punch cartoons. You have this woman, she's man-spreading, avant lettre, here. And then you have a very kind of slender-looking man, very kind of scared and moving away from her. She's too dominant. Woman, you know, the women should not be taking the upper hand quite like this. And then another punch cartoon, you have these four women playing cards, smoking, obviously a man's activity by and large. And the caption at the bottom says, is Florrie's engagement really off? And they said, oh yes, Jack wanted her to give up gambling and smoking, and she wouldn't. So, you know, which is, you know, a sign of a woman being independent, doing her own thing, but at the same time being rejected by the man she's supposed to marry. Now this, from the war era, the First World War era, shows exactly this. A woman is literally she's not at the front, she's in, I think these are in the UK, meant to be in the UK, but she is engaged in war. Again, this is what a man would be doing, but she is smoking, so you know she's hardcore. And obviously the First World War was a time when societal expectations were overturned, and of course women ended up getting the vote afterwards, not thanks to cigarettes, thanks to suffragettes, but you see here how these things are being overturned, and that cigarette is in some ways the symbol of her being quite so powerful. And then here you have the stance. You need to, if you're going to smoke, you need to adopt another stance because at the moment it's too manly. But of course, seeing that brought to mind another famous recent stance. We had a lot of Tory politicians who had been told by some management consultant that they had to stand like this to show how powerful they were. She hasn't got a cigarette, but no doubt at the moment she probably wants one. But then smoking becomes glamorous. It suddenly becomes sexy, and it becomes something women can do for themselves without being mannish. But of course, while still attracting men's desire, Marilyn Monroe, Lauren Bacall, Elizabeth Taylor, I mean, could smoking be more glamorous? No, it could not be. This is the peak of Hollywood's love affair. And I do, again, I'm not going to deny the sexualized aspect of it, but I think this time it's the woman being perhaps more empowered. But I mean, serious glamour. And just there are blogs devoted to Hollywood starlets smoking, which is very niche. It's a niche kink, but it exists. But then, in the 1950s, we started to realize, no thanks to the cigarette companies, but thanks to scientists, that cigarettes were incredibly bad for us. And smoking started to tail off because it became unacceptable. The government started to enforce laws against it. We started suing tobacco companies. And therefore, smoking became kind of contraband, or not contraband, but, you know, rebellious. And obviously, artists are the greatest rebels of all. And so you have Nan Goldin, who documented the 70s and 80s in New York from a very kind of louche, low milieu. And here you've just got her friend sitting on the cot, probably after a really hard night at the club. You know, it's probably 5 a.m. and she kind of needs to relax. And this is a way of englamorizing, it's not a word, it is now, englamorizing this again, but in a much different context. It's not saying you have to be a Hollywood starlet. It's saying this is a part of who you really are. This is, you're just doing something real and you're living your life. And they have Sarah Lucas, a young British artist, so-called, who uses cigarettes throughout her work with self-portraits. Now, from her perspective, she's spoken about this before, she sees cigarettes as sort of as an analog for herself, so they represent her. So in using them in a self-portrait, it's as realistic for her as using paint, or probably more realistic because it's a material she identifies with. She also associates cigarettes with pleasure. And so she said it's kind of like a bit of masturbation for me, if you'll forgive me. She feels that it's actually a joyful thing to be able to celebrate. Just when society is telling you, no, please don't smoke, it's bad for you, she's saying, you know, screw you, I'm actually going to stand up for myself and make my own decisions. And that's what visual art shows us, that actually smoking doesn't have to be so societally determined. It's very much an individualistic thing. And I think that's what lies at the root. I think now, smoking now, no one would necessarily get divorced over it, but perhaps there is some way in which some kind of smoking which is unappealing now, or not unappealing, but could cause controversy in a marriage. Susanna's new secret, she's got a massive blunt joint spliff, or whatever you want to call it. Makes me sound like I'm an expert, I'm really not. There. And if the Count came home and discovered that Susanna was passed out or had the munchies, then perhaps he would divorce her, but I suspect probably not even now. And I think that it's a nice image also of a woman reclaiming the cigarette for herself, and I think that that's probably what is at the root of this progression. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Josh. As I mentioned earlier, Susanna's Secret is not just about a woman and a cigarette, or indeed a woman and a joint, or a, what did you call it? Blunt? Okay. When we started researching Susanna's Secret, one of the first things we came across was Carl Ibsen's book, Fumo, A History of the Italian Tobacco Industry. In it was a translation of a passage from Matilda Serao's conduct book, Saper Vivere, How to Live, which was published in 1900 and republished subsequently many times. It included advice to young ladies on when and how to smoke in polite society. Serao, who knew Enrico Golisioni, the libretto writer for Susanna's Secret, wrote, 15 or 20 years ago, this question would have scandalized even the most liberal thinkers, and she was one. Today, instead, it is a pointless question. Many women, signore, smoke, and even young women, signorine, do. This passage led us to a book called Women and Smoking by Dr. Rosemary Elliott, published in 2007. I'm delighted that she's with us tonight. More recently, Rose has been studying the history of marriage, and with it, divorce. which makes her the perfect person to unpick the mores of the period in which Wolf Ferrari wrote the opera, the tension between tradition and modernity, male and female behaviour, and attitudes to Susanna's Vizietto Profumato.
Well, I should say I am thrilled to be asked to speak on this topic. I started working on smoking, as the date of the book suggests, quite some years ago. It was my PhD and my postgraduate work. Then the life events got in the way, and I was researching in Germany at that point and found I could no longer do this, so I needed a new project. And I was asked to start working with two other colleagues, Professor Gordon and Dr. Hughes, on a book on the history of marriage. I have spent some years working out how I am going to bring these two strands of my research together. This is the perfect opportunity. I'm genuinely thrilled. So I'm going to start off saying what Josh said, that for much of the 19th century, smoking was seen very much as a masculine habit. So in the 18th century, people used snuff. They didn't smoke. Some lower classes used pipes. And ladies would indulge in snuff as well. Snuff fell out of fashion and cigars came in for learned, educated, wealthy people. Now, cigars gained popularity. They became symbolic of male space. Ladies would not have smoked cigars. And in England, in Germany, and much of the continent, at this point, the main form of tobacco consumption was indeed cigars. So the smoking room, gentlemen's clubs, it was very much situated within male space. Just to give a bit of context, I am a social historian. This was part of a growing emphasis in the 19th century on gender differences. So we have the Enlightenment, which saw men as the rational intellectual beings. They are the ones who have the knowledge and the education to know which are good blends of tobacco, which are good cigars, and so on. But we've also got new medical understandings of men and women as biologically different and opposite. They're seen as incommensurate. Women are seen as mentally unstable due to the menopause, menstruation, processes of reproduction. They're seen as constantly in flux. So women are then pictured as coping within two ways: superior moral virtue, the respectable woman who rises above this, or the fallen woman, who then becomes enthralled to her sexual desire. So women who smoked at this point would have been associated with immorality, not being respectable, and indeed prostitution. You've also got the growth of evangelical Christianity and the Industrial Revolution, which separates the workplace and home. And so women are seen very much more in the domestic sphere than men in the workplace. Okay, so that's my rapid run through 19th century social history. When I was preparing this, I was thinking, how much did this apply across Europe? I mean, this opera was not written in England. But what we find is that these discourses are pan-European. The social and the scientific ideas between them cross Europe. To my first image, this is from a cigar box label from the John Johnson collection in the Bodleian. As you can see, even on cigar labels, you have images of ladies and images of that's also implying the Orient. And just to back up what I was saying, the Anti-Tobacco Journal in 1858 referred to women smoking in London as, quote, fallen females of the metropolis, describing these women as abandoned characters. And so their smoking symbolised waywardness and impropriety. Images for cigarettes in the early 20th century used these ideas as well, both drawing on the idea that tobacco was for male consumption, but also smoking among women was erotic material for men. This brings me to another point I wanted to make, which Josh has actually already covered, is that there was no awareness of the health risks of smoking as we now understand it. So the concerns really fitted in with temperance understandings, temperance concerns about addiction, about secondary poverty, around the fact it didn't smell good, and things like that. Now, here's where I want to kind of depart from the manly habit trope, because what you also see at the same time is women arguing that a cigarette is actually a feminine article, so it's okay for a woman to smoke it. This is a quote from Lady Colin Campbell. You may or may not have heard her. She's notorious if you're looking at marriage and divorce, because her and her husband were involved in a very expensive, very extensive divorce case in 1886. But she's written this afterwards. But she's talking about the inherent ugliness that the pipe would always mitigate against its universal adoption by women, whereas the cigarette seems to have been created especially for feminine fingers and lips. So she and others like her are directly arguing against it being seen as a manly product. Now, the cigarette in a lot of literature is seen as a feminine product because of the et on the end. Trade journal Tobacco noted in 1889, quote, "The smoking of cigarettes savours of the feminine and it's not suited to the English nation." However, when women did begin to smoke, as you see, and this is tied in with broader efforts to gain political and social independence, then there's this fear of that masculine woman, which Josh has already spoken about. I do want to make one point about this, which I've been reflecting on, is they are smoking in a private space. So a lot of women smoking is taking place in private. It might not be in secret, but it's not within the public domain, not always. There's a lot of discussion about women smoking in the press. It's very, very hard to tell the actual prevalence, whether it's just very well debated or whether a lot of women are actually smoking. It's very hard to get consumption figures, and it's very hard to know from retail figures who's buying the cigarettes. If we take Germany, for example, in the early 20th century, annual per capita consumption is 150. And if you split that between men and women, it's very, very few. So to give you a comparator, after the Second World War, annual per capita consumption in Britain was over 3,000. Now, here's Kate and Harry. I love Kate and Harry's cartoon. So this is a cartoon. This appeared in The Smoker. This is a periodical for tobacco aficionados. This is from 1882. I'm not sure if you can read it, but you can see Kate is smoking and Harry chances upon her. Harry, horrified at seeing Kate puffing a cigarette. "Mercy, do you smoke, Kate?" "Kate, well, not because I enjoy it, Harry. I want to fill the room with smoke so that should a burglar break in, he'll think there's a man in the house." "Harry," smiling, "my dear girl, you are only wasting your time and soiling your lips. A man never smokes cigarettes, at least no man that a burglar needs to be afraid of." A real man, of course, would have smoked cigars. So my question then, given that the opera was premiered in Munich in 1909, was how far these discourses spread beyond England, as I've said. Now, the work I've done in Germany really started from the 1930s, so I was a bit struggling to answer this question beyond the consumption figures I've said. What I found was essentially references to smoking on the continent. So this is from 1874, and it speaks again to the idea of the cigarettes being feminine. "So dainty, delicate, and withal harmless a method of indulging in the fumes of the fragrant weed is cigarette smoking, that the only objection to it is the fear lest our English ladies may take to it, as many ladies have done on the continent." And so this idea that women on the continent smoke is also present. This is a quote from Margot Asquith's biography in 1920. She describes when she's in Dresden, sitting with her hostess in loose moments, smoking cigarettes and eating black cherries. We discussed Shakespeare, Wagner, Brahms, Middlemarch, Bach and Hegel, and the time flew. So it's very much associated here with being an intellectual. Okay, so that's as far as I got with smoking on the continent. Now, my next question is, what could I find about smoking in marriage to connect my two projects? So I had the Lady Colin Campbell divorce case, as I've said. This went over 18 days. It was covered in the Times, it was covered in the Manchester Guardian, it was covered in the Scotsman, all the witnesses, it had the Duke of Marlborough, it had MPs, and it had the Lord Advocate. You know, it was a sensational case. And it talked about smoking. And Lady Colin Campbell, she had sued her husband for adultery and cruelty because women had to have two grounds, and he had then countersued her for adultery. Now, his proof was that she had been smoking with one of the correspondents, or she had been seen smoking, and this other witness had said that they had heard her return, this was a housemaid, with a man that was not Lord Campbell, and they had found the end of a cigar in an ashtray in the hallway. Now, that's all they say. Now, you have to draw the inference. So I looked up smoking in marriage, and I came up with the Lady Colin Campbell case. I thought, I know that already. It's very, very difficult to find information about functioning marriages. It's the problem. It's what you find is the non-functioning marriages. So then I looked up smoking and divorce, and this was much better. So here we go. This is my personal favorite. So I'll read it out to you. A prosperous Parisian shopkeeper wants a divorce. Now, this is a French husband filing a suit for divorce. It's called Only Smoke and Suspicion. He wants a divorce from his wife by reason of her suspicious conduct. He can prove nothing except her garments occasionally exhale an odour of tobacco. The judges have not gone very far in a difficult and delicate case. Some of the incriminated garments have been duly passed under the eyes and nose of a legal expert who arrived at the conclusion after mature deliberation that the clothes exhaled an odour, not of the ordinary headache-imparting corporal of commerce, but the subtle latakia, such as is smoked at palaces and harems of Oriental potentates. So there we go. Now, technical point, which might help you out here. Caporal is a variety of black ordinary tobacco grown in France. So this might be what you would expect to find if you were getting, you know, the smoke from a bus stop. Latakia, on the other hand, refers to the process of curing a more exotic Oriental tobacco. And it symbolises here much more sophisticated tastes than you might find in a public space. It's also a strong tobacco and is most often blended with other tobaccos in cigar or pipe smoking, usually by a specialist tobacconist at this point. So maybe I'm reading too much into this statement, but the implication is that the smoker is a connoisseur of tobacco, and by mentioning harems, quite possibly a male lover. So more divorce cases. Cigarettes and bicycles at fault. The statement of the tailor, Frank H. Cox: bicycle riding and cigarette smoking have been the principal causes of domestic infelicity. Cox was sued for divorce, his wife charging cruelty. Cox is alleged to have thrown a coffee pot at his wife's head. Cox says he struck the pot when it was in her hand and it cut Mrs. Cox's cheek. The occasion of the scene, he says, was the fact that on the preceding night he discovered his wife smoking cigarettes, which he had forbidden. Cox also says his wife persisted in going out alone on the streets at night. He did try to discipline her, for she is, he says, a bicycle rider, and persisted in riding in the evenings in company other than himself. I mean, it's shocking. And there's more. This is just my selection for this evening. This was a really rich vein of scholarship down here. So we have a Brooklyn man suing for divorce. He accuses his wife, Seth. They meet at each other's houses. He alleges to smoke, drink, and tell stories. That's her his grounds for divorce. What to make of all this? So the Count, I think, was very much a man of his time in some ways. Control of women's actions and habits was expected at the turn of the century. It was backed up with laws limiting women's opportunities, their professional advancement, their access to education, and until property law acts, their financial autonomy, in addition to not having the vote. And this was only slowly changing in the early 20th century. However, Jill does not take Susanna to the divorce court, maybe from relief that there is not another gentleman on the scene. He takes the decision to join his wife smoking. Now, this fits much more with what Lady Colin Campbell suggests is a good way forward. Men are never weary of justifying their love for tobacco, and they are perfectly right in their appreciation of its subtle benefits. But if it is all this, why should not women share in this last and best gift of the gods? But what she does is she justifies this in the prevailing understandings of the difference between men and women. This is not an argument for equality. There is no denying that women's nervous organisations are far more delicate and acute than the majority of men. A daily use of cigarettes would tend to largely eliminate the sense of irritation and induce a more philosophical frame of mind to the benefit of their husbands and of the world of land. So she's suggesting, with no impropriety, that it's a good thing for men if their wives smoke. She carries on. The pleasure to a tired and harassed man to find his way back from his office to a quiet drawing room where,
A low-voiced woman welcomes him, rising out of the billowy silken cushions, a cigarette just removed from her lips. O men, my brothers, such an experience when you in turn sink into the chair, a cigarette or a cigar between your lips, your favourite drink at your elbow, and your wife smoking her cigarette opposite you, is a foretaste of paradise. Now you know. So finally, what I am suggesting here is that it fits very much more in an emerging discourse of companionate marriage. This is not necessarily about equality, so it's changing it slightly from where we see the new woman being a manly woman and trying to keep pace with men, if you like, by taking on male habits and privilege. But this is much more about men and women enjoying time and space together, but not upsetting social structures. And the final point I want to make is where I think the opera speaks to modernity. It's the Count who doesn't smoke and Susanna who does. And to me, that inverts the usual trope whereby the woman frowns on and is excluded from male smoking and turns it on its head. Rather than seeing smoking as a sign of suspicion of greater impropriety, Wolf Ferrari's opera positions it as an opportunity to start to dismantle the separate spheres which characterise the 19th century marital state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rose. Do you think that there's a way in which we could say that maybe Susanna is a 20th century wife and Jules is a 19th century husband? Are they just trying to navigate their way through to the 20th century?
I think that's a really, really helpful way of looking at it. The challenge I had with it, I started off thinking Susanna fits within the new woman. She's emancipated, she wants to smoke, and all of the associations that that brings with it. But when you start to think about the spaces in which she's smoking, it's domestic, private space, it's not a public space, she's not challenging any political structures, she's doing it within the domestic sphere. And the fact that she wants her own space and her own autonomy to do that, but she's not, in the end of it, upsetting the marriage. So I think it is about that negotiation of attitudes, precisely around about women's position and their personal autonomy.
I'd like to open this up to questions from the floor, but I want to do a question to the floor, first of all, which is just to talk to John Andrews, who's going to be conducting Il Segreto di Susanna this summer. John, I want to know what your perspective is on this score, which has got its little bits of Humperdinck. The aria sounded like a little bit like Puccini mashed with Mozart. We've got the Chopinesque piano bit. It should be a mess or a stramash, but it's not. It's gorgeous. It's beautifully put together.
Well, I think you're absolutely right to say it should be a mess, and it is amazing that it's not. But I think one of the things that you get from that layering is that a lot of these ideas that we've been talking about tonight can then sit one on top of each other, and that's where the interest comes. I mean, I'd like to say as a prelude, I always like to get quickly into the social and historical context of a piece, and I'm absolutely delighted that a man as erudite as Donald struggled to find anything about it, because it makes me feel a lot less guilty about the problems that I've had. But to be serious, I think because we've got this idea of a sort of Venetian intermezzo in there, that takes us back to a world of marital and domestic and to be blunt, sex comedies, that all these ideas can then sit on top of. And I think I would almost draw also a parallel with Mozart and the trouser rolls, because we've got a situation here where you don't need a lot of Italian to appreciate quite how sexualized the language is in that aria about the cigarette. There's no doubt that what we have here is an idea of a woman in her own space enjoying her own pleasure as something which is which can only be represented on stage at one tactful remove. So just as in order to show a really sexually aroused woman on stage in the 18th century, you have to put them in trousers and pretend they're a boy, here you have to pretend we're talking about a cigarette. And that's not the only thing that's going on. And I think I want to be clear, I don't think it's that blunt, but that goes then in as a layer. And that it's the pastiching that allows you to mix that with those social ideas and allows us to have a character who is at once sitting in an 18th century intermezzo about a married couple, and it's also a figure of 20th century social enlightenment and emancipation. So with all these ideas, somehow comes a coherence. And of course, the same thing that happens in Rosenkavalier, where you have the 18th century through a 19th century or 20th century perspective. And in instrumental music, you're seeing it in Respighi is doing similar things with Liucelli. He's taking 17th and 18th century courtly dances and reorchestrating them. And of course, then it goes forward into Stravinsky. So we're at a moment in which composers can telescope a whole range of ideas across the generations. And I think that's one of the reasons why the work is so interesting and so fun, because as you say, we have Chopin, we have Puccini, we have the Venetian comedy, and somehow, magically, they blend in a fantastically complex and interesting way without disturbing each other.
It's there in the score as well, isn't it? I mean, you can actually physically see him layering subject over another one, and then it just fits together perfectly.
Absolutely,
like
but as you say, you look at it on the score, and your first impression looking on the score is that's never going to work, and you think, but how is that? But then it does, and he's done something very, very. Very, very clever. And I don't know how intentionally he was doing that or how much he was simply absorbing all of this, which he would have seen every day and been all around him. But certainly these ideas of the relationship between smoking and emancipation and private spaces and public spaces are all there, and they're all to be enjoyed.
Thank you very, very much. Il Segreto di Susanna opens in double bill with Tchaikovsky's Jolanta on July the 22nd. Tickets, casting details can be found on our website, operahollandpark.com. So do have a look on our website. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you all.